Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik, and yay, we've made the double digits. That's awesome. This episode is with Danielle K.L. Gregoire, and she is the founder of The Comedy Womb, which is celebrating its two-year anniversary. Can you believe it? It is a space at the Rendezvous Tuesday nights, 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock shows. You can learn more at comedywomb.com or email Danielle at comedywombforever@gmail.com. And she's just done amazing work to create this space that supports female-identifying comics. And it's a hate-free space, so no sexism or homophobia is allowed in people's sets. And she is amazing, and I really hope that you enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone. We're here with Danielle K.L. Gregoire, the founder of The Comedy Womb. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about your origins. When you were growing up, when did you start enjoying making people laugh?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. I've been thinking about it a lot lately. I think I wasn't as much as enjoyment at first as like survival skills, right?
I totally understand that.
Okay, so, like, my parents moved me around a lot as a kid, so I moved from Flin Flon, Manitoba.
Let's say that name again?
Flin Flon, Manitoba. I know. It's in its name, just funny, and that's where I gestated, so maybe that's part of why I'm funny. And we moved to another town, and, like, when you're moving and you're the new person, often, I mean, not when you're really little, but when I was 13, I moved to the Paw, Manitoba.
Damn it. That's it's all part of the color of podcasting.
Let's see. So I moved around, and I moved to this town. All of the towns had really interesting names, I suppose. The Paw, Manitoba, was where I moved when I was 13 years old, and it was a little rougher kind of town, like a mill town. And I don't know, I wasn't immediately liked, right? Because I was a new girl in town. And,
right.
And I just found that in order to not get beat up, I would just joke and riff and sort of, like, try to make myself more likable. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of my, like, foundation steps into comedy. I remember my favorite joke that I've ever told was probably when I just turned 16. I was working at a convenience store. I was the victim of a robbery in the middle of broad daylight. It was 7 p.m. in northern Manitoba, so it was bright out. And a guy came in with a knife, and it's okay.
Sorry, I know. I'm an actor. I get really reactive.
Right, and then, so it was terrifying, and he didn't get any of the money, but he did come around on the other side and, like, you know, like, was standing next to me with a knife and, like, threatening me, and then almost stabbed the dog, and I grabbed his arm, and it was huge and tattooed, and, you know, and my boss saved me, and he ran out, and then later, like, my boss's mother was there, and she was like, "Do you need a cigarette?" I was like, "I'm 16. She was like, "Did you need a drink?" I'm like, "Yeah, probably." So I had my first drink, and then we went back into work in the store right after the robbery.
So there's no break.
There was no break. So okay, me and my boss were standing right behind the thing. And then this man came in and he was like, "Why are all the cop cars out there?" And just immediately I was like, "Oh, we started selling donuts." And my boss starts laughing hysterically. You know what I mean? But that's just my first instinct, is to be like, eh. Whatever first thought. You know, like, to go for humor.
Right. Well, mm-hmm. I think it's a positive. I think people sort of underestimate how it can be a defense mechanism and also be really healing.
Right. It dispels any sort of tension, right? Like a laughter sort of does that thing. So, yeah. So I understand what it's like to be uncomfortable, because I've been in a lot of towns and the new person, and being uncomfortable is sort of like my norm. But I like to make other people feel comfortable, and humor is a really good way to do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So when you... Do you write jokes? Do you plan it out? Like, are you more of someone who riffs off of a crowd?
I used to write all of my jokes, but I'd spent 10 years doing slam poetry and spoken word poetry, so I wrote everything to a T and memorized it exactly. And when I started stand-up, I sort of wanted to get away from that precision of language to more of a natural use. So I will come up with premises, and then I will orally work them out on audiences until I get to a point where I enjoy them. There's a comic in Seattle who I watch, every time I watch her, her sets, they're incredible, but the wording isn't ever exactly the same. And so it feels fresh every time.
Sure.
Like, she knows the story so well, but it's not identical. So, yeah, it's, I enjoy that part of it, where, because I've seen sets where they're precisely written, and I watch so much comedy.
Obviously.
So, that I, like, it's sort of nice to watch the people who are just sort of like, hey, I thought about this thing today, and then they're naturally funny, and that's sort of what I'm going for now, is a more conversational style, more observational style.
So if we can sort of backtrack to Canada after the donut joke incident slash robbery, where did you go to college?
I went to the University of Manitoba when I was 18, which is in Winnipeg, which the whole country is full of interestingly named places. Yes, I did a theater degree. It wasn't actually a theater degree. It was an English degree, in scare quotes, because my dad wanted it to be a serious degree, but all of my credits were in theater or film. So I have a film and theater degree underneath the guise of an English literature degree, my first degree.
Mm-hmm. So during college, were you performing comedy, or were you mainly sticking to scripted plays?
And theater, yeah. Mostly theater and improv in university. Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What, would you do improv shows, sort of like UCB, or would you have audiences come?
I performed at the improv festival, the IF festival in Winnipeg, and a long form improv show once, and then I've moved all over the place. My life is like this checkered map of moving places. I lived in Vancouver, and I did a lot of improv out there as well, but mostly just classes, and yeah,
And then did the improv sort of feed into the slam poetry? Were they parallel or intersecting lines?
Parallel. Yeah, I found slam poetry. I was a radio DJ in Winnipeg. I was the first female radio DJ back on the air at the University of Manitoba radio station, UMFM 101.5. And I was listening to late night radio, and I heard, I think it was a Jill Scott poem. And I was just like, what is this? Amazing stuff. And then I called the DJ, and he was like, oh, it's spoken word, idiot. like, how do you not know about spoken word? And I was probably about 19 or 20. And then I started writing some really crappy spoken word, because I'd written poetry my whole life, right? Because when you're a loner and you don't have a lot of friends or whatever, you live in the middle of nowhere and your parents have kept you away from people, you write, or at least I did. I read and I wrote. Express
and organize emotion and your experiences.
So, like, the idea that I could read my poems out loud and have people listen to them, and they got better. And I moved to Vancouver, and there's a huge slam poetry scene out there. And so my very first poetry show, this is going to be, like, weird Canadian, like, esoteric stuff.
I love it.
Okay.
I love it.
Was full of, like, all of, like, the top poets in the country at the time, just accidentally. Like, I just went to this weird show at the Crush Champagne Lounge. It was my very first spoken word show, and I don't know if you watched the Olympics, the Canadian Olympics that year. Mm-mm. There was a man on top of a gigantic cake doing poetry. It was my friend Shane Koizan, and he was at that show that night, and then it was just incredible. It's so weird talking about Canada when I'm in America, because it's out of a reference, out of frame. Like, I can't talk about it. Where if I'm in Canada, people are like, oh, Shane Koizan, right? He was the poet at the Olympics and then opening ceremonies. Anyway, and he just happened to be one of the first guys that I saw. And he's incredible. Like, if you can interview him, ugh.
I'll make a note of it. Because cake and poetry are two really awesome things.
Totally, yeah. I don't think it was an actual cake. It was just that he's terrified of heights, and he was, like, way off the ground on this gigantic cake-like structure. And they had to, like, tether him to it so he wouldn't fall off or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is taking risks for your work.
Your art, yeah. Certainly. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, did the poetry, spoken word, how did that sort of transition into stand-up comedy?
Good question. So after a decade of doing poetry and, like, organizing slams and helping run national festivals and performing and teaching poetry, I'd seen a lot of poetry and a lot of really great poetry, and I moved here and I thought, I'll do poetry here too, or whatever, in 2012. And I started doing it, and I realized that my stuff's all really Canadian, first of all. So it's not really connectable. You don't realize that it's a different country until you start doing poetry, and you're like, oh, I just talked about how I met a little boy in, like, Camp Sac, Saskatchewan. And they're like, where is that? And so I was like, maybe I could start all over. Just start from scratch. And so I wanted to do comedy. And I think my origin comedy story has to be, I saw a stand-up comedian, he was 14, at band camp in America, because I went to Peace Gardens, which is, like, on the Minnesota-Manitoba border, and I was a drummer, and there was a talent show, and I think I was singing, like, an original song or something, and then this kid gets up, and he looked like the kid from Terminator 2, Edward Furlong, so super cute, adorable, and he does this original set about the types of friends he had, and he was super geeky, right? And he managed to work chlorofluorocarbons into his set, and it was just brilliant, and he had 1,000 kids laughing for 5 minutes straight. And I was like, oh, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. I want to do that. Like, this is incredible, right? And then instead of doing it, I asked him out, because my friend told me I didn't have a snowball's chance in hell. He said yes, and then I dated him, and he was actually the first person that, you know, when Facebook started, right, I looked him up to see if he was a stand-up, and he wasn't.
Interesting.
Yeah, he does Ren Faire stuff, which...
There's still a performative quality exactly. to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so, like, fast forward 20 years, I'm like, I'm gonna do it. I used to watch open mics, stand-up open mics in Canada all the time, like the Pro-Am mics that we have up there, and I never felt comfortable going on stage, which is funny, because I'm comfortable in front of a microphone and have been, like, my whole life.
What do you think that block was, or that hurdle? Was it self-imposed?
I think. I don't know. There wasn't a lot of women on stage. There was one woman who I would see do jokes over and over and over again, and her opener was, so the T went out on the Hooters sign, so now I can finally work there. And that was her joke. I watched her for 2 years. That was her opener for 2 years. And, like, I remember one day being like, I just yelled out her opener. I know.
Wow.
And she walked off the stage. Right? Mm-hmm. But I literally saw her week after week after week after week, like,
right,
like 52 weeks in a row, probably. And she would do that joke every time for her opener. And I was just like, when are you going to write new jokes? Right? But I didn't understand how much work goes into, like, getting a solid opener. And now I feel terrible, obviously, for having done that to her. But also, yeah, I didn't see myself represented on stage during comedy, and, like, a lot of the material is questionable in regards to women.
It's interesting. There's a comedian. I live on Whidbey Island, and there's a comedian who grew up there. His name is Brian Moot.
Oh, Moot.
And so, do you know him?
Yeah.
And so he, a couple years ago, he brought a couple of his roommates up to do a show at this, like, 100-year-old movie theater that's in downtown Langley. And there was one guy who went up, and it was just this really sexist set, and Whidbey Island's kind of progressive, liberal-minded, and he was getting no laughs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think hopefully that's indicative of audiences evolving and being more discerning about their comedy and not laughing at something if it's offensive or aggressive towards a certain...
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, we do live in a sort of bubble out in our neighbor neck of the woods, because, I mean, a lot of my comics will leave. I had one friend who played this game. She went to, I think, maybe New York, and she was texting me every time she heard a rape joke on stage, and I was like, I don't like this game. Mm-hmm. Right? She was just like, another one, and I'm just like, why are, like, what is it about that we need to, like, joke about it? Like, I understand that it's a horrible subject, but if it's never happened to you and you're using it as, like, victims as the butt of the joke, like, what is it? Why do you need to do that?
Right.
Like, what is so funny about that to you? Like, I don't know, because I don't know a lot of people who do that anymore, because I don't surround myself with those people. Yeah. So, mm-hmm.
All right, so going back to the first time, can you remember the first time you officially went up on stage to do a set?
September 29th, 2012. Bam. I know, because I blogged it. Like, yeah. I wrote the set out completely.
What was that experience like?
The writing the set. I went to the open mic twice before I even, like, I was out to watch. And it was at Proc, which is now Scratch Deli on 12th.
Okay, sure.
In Capitol Hill. And it was run by this guy named Tristan Devon. He was super welcoming. I went there because my friends are improvers, and they were like, oh, there's this really good thing, People's Republic of Comedy, you should go there. It's sort of a coffee house vibe. It's not as scary as, say, like a club open mic for your first time. And I went twice, and then I messaged Tristan, and I was like, look, I'm coming from Bellevue, which is outside of Seattle. I can't get in there in time for the signups, and, like, I get one night out a week because I'm breastfeeding, so I guess this is at the time. And so he was like, I'm going to make this easier for you. Just send me your name and I'll sign you up and I'll make sure that you're in the second half of the mic so you can get there in time, you can find parking. And he was so sweet about it. And he was like, when I went up on stage, I was terrified, obviously. And it was so nice to be terrified on stage, if you know what I mean, like to be afraid again, because after 10 years of just going on stage, yes, you just get accustomed to it and it's like second skin, like, right, you just walk on stage and you're confident. So to be shaking,
I have that adrenaline,
right? Yeah, it was so exciting. And my set was just like about me being Canadian and the weirdness of being Canadian in America, because I just moved from Canada to the States. And it, like, I even had, like, I had callbacks, I had reach outs, like, everything that I'd seen on stage, like, a little bit about me, like, all of those things, like, a story within. And it was only 4 minutes long. I'm pretty sure I burnt the light that time. And, like, I asked the audience questions, like, and had them interact with the set. It was a really, I thought, a very good set. And, like, there are two different kinds of sets when you start. There's the set where, like, you're like, I have no idea what I'm going to talk about. And I just want to try stand-up comedy, and it's my bucket list. So I'm not going to write my set. And then the people like me who've been waiting 20 years to do it. And I'd just written it and practiced it and practiced it until it was just like, yeah. And it was good, but also it was sort of poetic because I had this poetry background, right? Sure. So the segues and everything ran into each other, and it wasn't jokes as much as just, like, observational comedy about myself and, like, the way people are. Yeah. But I was hooked immediately. Like,
energetically, what did you get back from the audience?
Oh, that, yeah, first they laughed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was so great.
You had that kernel of encouragement.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's the worst. If you have a good first set, you're just always looking, chasing that first set again, right?
And so that gave you momentum,
yeah,
to keep pursuing it more regularly.
Yeah. And so I went up a few more times, and then Tristan actually took his own life, and so the mic shut down.
Right.
Right, so I guess he was very depressed, chemically depressed, and he had a bad night. And then someone messaged me, and they were like, did you know this person? And I was like, oh, yeah, no, he's the person who, you know, who runs the open mic that I go to. And they're like, well, this. And I was just like, do I quit now? Like, what do I do? Like, I never felt comfortable doing it anywhere else, so why? And then I realized, like, that's not what he would have wanted. He wasn't doing it to affect anyone else. It wasn't like a statement where he was like, everyone should quit comedy. It was just, he had a bad night. And so I started going down to the club to get on stage. And, you generally need people to come with you, and I didn't have any friends that weren't comics, because I hadn't made any friends that weren't comics in Seattle. So I didn't have any friends, and I didn't understand how it worked. And I signed up, and there was like two women on the open mic list.
Out of how many?
One other,
out of how many?
I don't know,
slots?
Like 70. Oh, 70 people signed up, and like maybe 38 slots.
Wow.
32 to 38, depending on the night. And then I was in the audience, and I was watching, like, white straight dude after white straight dude. And I love white straight dudes.
They're awesome, right? But there's, yeah, a lot
just,
of them.
Right, exactly. And just go up after one after another, one after another, one after another. And I was, like, 17 in or something like that. And I was hanging out with my guy friends, who happened to all be mostly white straight dudes, who were, like, sitting in the audience with me. They just started comedy, too. And I went to the bathroom, and the lights were out in the bathroom, and I peed in the dark in the women's washroom. And I was just like, this, like, I'm starting my own show. Like, I can't afford to come out at 6 o'clock, not put my kids to bed, wait in line, sign up, and then not get on.
And so in that moment,
I said, I'm starting my own show. And then I was like 3 months into my comedy career at that point. That was it. And I messaged, there's a friend of mine in Canada. Her name's Deanne Smith. And she is an incredible comic. And I gave her 25 minutes when I was doing slam poetry shows, like back in 2006. And I was super excited about like having someone else besides a poet come in and do my poetry slam as a feature. And she did comedy and poetry and stuff. And I messaged her right away and I said, do you think it's egotistical of me to want to start like a female focused open mic or something where like half the spots are reserved for women? And she was like, do it. And so kind of with like, she'd been doing comedy for like 12 years and running shows forever and stuff. And I was like, okay. So then I started collecting information and trying not to step on anybody's toes and trying to be a part of the community so that my addition wasn't seen as like a pushback.
Interloper.
Yeah. It was just like, hey, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to try to get more women into comedy. It'll be good for everybody, I think. Because one of the things at the clubs, were they were like, well, percentages. Like, if there's only 2 women, 70 dudes, like, why should you get a spot? And I'm like, you know what? Fairness, I guess. If that's how it works, then so maybe I'll get more women, and then there'll be more women on stage, and then more women will see me. It's a perpetuating cycle, right? Instead of complaining about it, I was just like, no, okay. And I helped run one of the longest running slams in Canada for like 3 or 4 years, and like I'd started the only English speaking rural slam series in Canada and would send people, like, so running shows and slam poetry shows are hard to push, especially if you're in the middle of nowhere in like the county. Right? So I'm like, if I can do that, I can produce and promote a comedy show where I don't have to explain what comedy is. People know what stand-up is. When you say, I'm running a slam poetry show, we're like, are you hurting people with your poetry? Is it like mixed martial arts and poetry together? What is the slam part of it? I don't understand. So, like, I was just like, this is so much easier. And then I got together, like, this group of people I trusted from my open mic, kind of, like, friends, and asked them who I should book on my first shows. And I wanted to do a pro-am mic like in Canada, so you'd have an open mic, like 16 people or whatever, and then a feature set at the end. You pay that person to come and perform poetry. You charge $5, and so at the end of the night you get someone solid. So even if the whole open mic has sucked, which it doesn't ever, and like I've never been disappointed with the open mic in my room. Yeah, so that's how it started. And I had workshops, too, where I brought in comics who'd been doing it for a long time. My friend Yogi Palawal, who moved to New York, and my friend Leah Mansfield, who's like was in L.A. for a while. I asked them to come and talk to people who had never done comedy and have those people present their first sets. And so three of the people who started in my room on the very first night are still doing comedy. One of them got into Bridgetown, so she's only been doing comedy for under 2 years. And, like, another one's running a room, and the other one's doing, like, it was really cool. So, and I thought, like, why aren't women participating? And I thought, maybe it's because no one asked them to.
Have you seen the documentary on Netflix, Women Aren't Funny?
No, but I was at All Jane when she was there, and she was releasing it, but I haven't watched it yet. But I know that that's the trope, the women aren't funny thing. I try not to say it ever.
Oh.
Right?
It's painful for me to say, at least perfect, you know.
Well, because it's not, like, it's not even remotely true. Like, that people can even say it makes me laugh so hard.
It's funny in and of itself.
It's funny, yeah. It's ironic because I laugh at women all of the time. And not just in stand-up comedy circles. Like, you're just at the grocery store and your clerk is, like, cracking you up and she's a woman. You know what I mean? And that we're naturally funny because if it's a defense mechanism... We have to be, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I read the Christopher Hitchens article, too, and I was just like...
But what, I mean, to me, it's so ridiculous that someone would even say that.
Ever. Yeah.
But how do you engage that person in a conversation?
I don't.
When that's like...
I just laugh.
You just laugh?
I just laugh. I'm not even gonna...
It's kind of like wasted energy to try to prove your point. It's super wasted energy.
Yeah, no, I'm not... I watch a whole room of people... 40 to 60 people twice a night, every Tuesday night, laugh at people who self-identify as women. You know what I mean? Like, I see it every week. I don't need to engage that person ever again. because I know it's not true. It's like fighting a racist who, like, has some idea that, that, you know, like, this thing is a true thing. And you're like, why? Why are we even talking about this anymore? Like, seriously. Yeah, so, yeah, I don't.
That's awesome. I'm just going to steal that answer now, because I'm like, maybe it's something within myself, or I could just really reach out to them and connect. And
right. I mean, you can if you want.
You can try to be funny, I suppose, but no.
Yeah. No, no.
Kicking those people to the curb.
Yeah.
Henceforth.
Mm-hmm.
So when you started, mm-hmm. So this is April of 2013.
Was the first open mic that I started. April 2nd was the first, yeah, the first Comedy Womb.
Mm-hmm. What was that night like? Who came out? What was the room like?
65 people. Civilians, we call them. and then I think about 16 comics, and half of them were, like, 8 were women and 8 were men. And it was a phenomenal night. It was just high energy. I don't even remember who hosted, but I train hosts in that room too, so that, like, all of the spots are sort of learning spaces. But yeah, it was incredible. I don't know how I got 65 people to come out. I just, everywhere I went, I would talk about this thing that I was doing for 3 months. And people were like, oh, that sounds really interesting. That sounds really interesting. And then, yeah, everywhere that I went. And and the audience was incredible. And the first 3 shows, someone from The Stranger came to write about it. So 3 times. Sienna Madrid, she came down.
I know Sienna Madrid.
Yeah.
She's a Hedgebrook alum.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, so she wrote about it, but she came 3 times, and she just happened to be there the one night that I didn't pre-vet this guy who got on stage. And it was like the second night of the Comedy Womb. And my friend Alicia, who was not my friend at the time, she was like this incredible comic. I was super excited to have her. She was sitting in the back with her friends. And this guy gets on stage, and he'd come down, and he'd signed up upstairs because there was a literary open mic, and he was like, oh, I think this is the one I want to. And he seemed so sweet and nice. And then he went on stage and started talking about hookers and prostitutes and strippers and how unnecessary they are and how gross it is and how, you know, if a woman offered to jack him off, he would crack her in the face. Because he could do that by himself. So at that point, I lit him, which is like it was like maybe 45 seconds to 1 minute in.
You're done.
Yeah, and he was like sort of confused, right? But no one laughed. Not a single person laughed because it wasn't funny. None of it was funny. It was just really hateful material. And then he was like, well, I think I'll go to this. And his closer was date rape. Why would I date a woman before I raped her?
That is atrocious.
Right. And so Alicia Sanchez and Sarah Skilling from the back, like, my room's definitely a heckle-free room, but Sarah goes, what? Or something like that. And then, get off the stage, Alicia. Like, it was just like, and then he gets off the stage. And I was on the other side, and I was just horrified because I'd promised a safer space sort of environment, and this guy had gone up and done the same shit that would have happened at a club, which is just like he thinks that he's deconstructing the world by talking about why there needs to be. And I gave him a hug and I was like, did you not know this is a female focused, female friendly room? And he was like, oh no. And he seemed apologetic. Oh, I know who was hosting that night. My friend Isaac was hosting that night because he got a text from a friend who was at a bus stop talking to a guy who had been misunderstood at an open mic. And his rawness had gone you know what I mean? Like, so that guy had gone to a bus stop, had accidentally started talking to my friend Isaac's friend.
About how his feelings were hurt.
How his feelings were hurt, and how no one had laughed, and they just didn't get him. And I was like, oh my gosh. And so now I've always been on a high alert since then, so someone will come down, they're like, I want to sign up tonight, and I'm like, you can't. Unless they're like a woman. And I'm like, here are the rules. And they're like, oh, thank God, I'm finally in the space where I feel safe. Then I'm like, yes, you can get on. But if it's someone who I say the word misogyny and they squint a little.
What?
I don't understand what that word means. Like, what are you saying? I'm not allowed to say. Or what? My freedom of speech is being. And I was like, no, you don't understand. I'm not your government. This is my freedom of speech. I am saying in this space, my freedom of speech it takes precedent. You can. I'm not stopping anyone from doing comedy anywhere else. I'm just saying here is where we're thoughtful. I'm not forcing anyone to stop.
So what guidelines do you sort of get? Because I feel that that's a revolutionary act.
My friend said it was radical, that also that I was engaging men and allowing allies to be a part of it too, right? Or so she was like, this, and it shouldn't be a radical act to ask people to be not hateful. But I'm Canadian, right? So hate speech is a thing where you can go to jail for it, where I'm from. So, like, before it becomes a hate crime, you can sort of see where it starts. So my rules are pretty much punch up, not down. Tell your own story. No misogyny, which is like, we don't hate women. And like that can come from anything. Like, a lot of people will get recently divorced and talk about how slutty their wife is or whatever. And I'm like, not here. Not unless you're going to like dig deeper into yourself and see maybe that there is more to it about than that. You know what I mean? Like, right. If you're going to deconstruct it. But I mean, there's lots of spaces for really hurt men who have been hurt by women in their life who aren't going to extrapolate it to all women. You know what I mean? So no misogyny, no racism. I mean, you can talk about racial things, but in the end, it's sort of, I think, better for you to let someone else tell their own story than to white knight or whatever it is. Like, we're at the point where there's enough people of color and queer people and women and trans people and on stage talking about their own stories that you don't need to tell their story for them anymore.
Your commentary is not welcome. Right. It's not necessary.
It's not necessary. Right, like, but originally it was. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because there weren't, those people weren't being represented on stage. And so, like, there's a lot of allies and men who are allies who would tell jokes about how horrible it was to be black or whatever and stuff. And I think we're sort of at the point where, I don't know, that would be nice if we stopped. We just listened instead of talking all of the time. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So that, I sort of like, so I, whenever someone comes to me, I send them a huge message being like, hey, this is the guidelines of the room. It's a safer space. Yeah, like, it may not be for you. Maybe you don't want to have to censor yourself, and that's totally all right. But if you agree to come to this mic, know that there's no homophobia, no misogyny, no transphobia, no body shaming. No, you know, like, all the stuff, like, just the horrible stuff that you have to listen to in other rooms that people don't even necessarily realize that they're doing. You know what I mean?
I remember the night that I came, mm-hmm. My friend Darcy was doing stand-up mm-hmm. for the first time, mm-hmm. and there was one guy who did sort of a little bit of a sexist joke at the end of his set, and since you were hosting, you came up and you did a correction, and I think you were like, well, I think that you meant that any person could have had that behavior.
Right.
Moving on.
Totally, yeah.
So mm-hmm. how do you sort of, I don't want to say correct, or if those jokes somehow slip through?
I talk to them after. It's sort of a dialogue. I'd like to tell my audience that it's a mediated dialogue. So if you have a problem with someone's set, come to me and I will talk to them. So, because whenever you're reprimanded or you're told about your creative work being not all right or something, you know, your first impulse is going to be defensive because you thought about it and you took it to the stage. You know what I mean? And it's hard to hear. Maybe that's not okay. Maybe you hurt someone, right? So I like to be that person to talk to them first. And a lot of them will go, ugh, but it wasn't hateful, Danielle. And I'm like, someone is concerned about it. And, like, let's talk about it, you know? And if you decide that that joke is your joke, and maybe just don't do it in my room, keep it and do it in other rooms and see how it works. And but a lot of people will come around and be like, you're right. Yeah, I was just working it out. And so it is. It's a mediated dialogue so that it's safer. And then if I see that audience member again, I'd be like, well, I talked to the comic. So thank you very much for your input. And, like, they listened and stuff and sort of, as opposed to, like, people attacking each other.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's a more civil discussion.
That's so awesome.
Mm-hmm. And if someone is being horrible, I do light them early. I've had to walk people off stage before.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But not very often. Because a lot of people know. that, like, I mean, that's why they're there. They're there because there's an audience of people who want to be there. Like, actual audience members.
So, in terms of the people who sign up both for the open mic and then the audience members who come, are there a lot of repeat attendees? Or does it sort of, over the 2 years, how has it grown or what patterns have you seen?
The comics tend to come in cycles. So, you'll get, like, a big swath of, like, newbies and some of the people who come all the time. And then they'll move out into the other world of open mics, right? Because it is a safer space, so you kind of want to challenge yourself elsewhere and see if your jokes are funny.
So they sort of have the training wheels.
Right, they get the training wheels, and then they're welcome back anytime. Like, I have people who started in my room who still continue to come back. But I, like, there's only so many spaces, too, right? Like, I think it was last year, at the point where I had, like, 40 comics on the mic and I had, like, 100 people wanting to watch the show, where I decided that I had to split into two shows. I had a Tuesday and Wednesday night mic, and then I was like, oh, my, this is exhausting. So I decided to do two, like, 1.5-hour mics instead of 2 4-hour mics on, like, a Tuesday and a Wednesday, because I could get 80 comics up, but I think 40 is enough on a Tuesday, and then the audience gets, like, 1.5 hours of comedy, and then they get to leave. But I have seen a lot of new people. Sometimes, like, I'll ask people at the door, like, why are you here? Who are you here to see? And they're like, no one. I'm just here for a comedy show. And that is really, like, that's been happening more and more often, whereas people have just heard about it, and they want to come down and watch, and they're not there to see one of their friends, or... And I don't make any of the comics bring friends in order to get on. That was one of my things, because I was like, I didn't have any friends when I started, and a lot of people don't want their friends to see them at the very beginning of their art form, and that's perfectly reasonable, right? Because you're not as good as you could be yet, and some people really want their friends to come. But the best compliment I think I've received about The Womb was that it's not a show where you have to bring your friends, but it's a show where you want to bring your friends. So that's kind of cool.
That's a sterling recommendation right there. Yeah.
Totally.
So how do you choose the headliners?
In the beginning, it was just like, oh, there's not a lot of women in Seattle who are able to do 20 minutes, so I just, all of them, I did, like, so, and then now that we're at, like, comics are at a year or 2 years now, there's a lot more people to choose from. I like to sort of oscillate between professional comics and comics doing their first 20 minutes, or comics who are, like, just working on 20 minutes, so that you can see a place to go and see a place to work towards. So you're like, oh, I'm going to do this 3 minutes every week, but someday I'm going to have 20 minutes. I'm going to get paid $100 to do 20 minutes of comedy in front of, like, an audience. It's kind of cool. So, yeah, there's that. I used to do a show called Comedy Birth where I would kick people out and they weren't allowed to come back for a month, but I didn't like it because I was like, ugh, you should be allowed to come back if you want to relax and enjoy yourself, you know. And now I do a show called Embryos, so comics underneath 9 months, and I'll do a show at Pocket Theater for them so that they get out of the womb and into a different space and get to do 5 of their best minutes. So it's not an open mic, it's a showcase, and there's usually about 65 audience members watching them.
How often does that happen?
Like every quarterly, probably. Whenever I feel like there's 10 comics in my room I'm watching and that they're really, you know, really good and they're dedicated. So I want to reward that sort of, like, coming every week and that commitment, because it's really hard to commit to comedy because it is 3 minutes at a time. You know what I mean? Like, that's you can't just sit and draw for, like, 6 hours. The only way you're not going to know if your jokes are any good is if you put them in front of an audience.
Do you find the people who come to you, do they have similar backgrounds? I know the headliner, the night that I came, I believe was a high school guidance counselor.
High school guidance.
For her day job.
She's always Katie Carper. Danielle
Steele.
Katie Carper.
Jokes.
Yeah. I've seen her, she's been doing comedy for over 2 years, I guess, but she can't go out all the time because she's a teacher, right? So she does all of her work in the summers most of the time, so she'll come and do, completely different backgrounds. Like, I used to go to a lot more open mics. I'd have more time to go to open mics. And I would see comics and I would tell them to come. Or people who've come to do The Womb, they're out at other open mics and they see a woman on stage who they think could benefit from, like, maybe a different, more supportive space or whatever. And they'll tell them to come to The Womb. And so Katie was one of the people that I saw at Scratch Deli. And I was like, oh, you're so funny. You need to come to the womb. And so she would come every once in a while. And I was like, hey, you want to come do 20? And she was like, really? And I'm like, yes.
She was hilarious.
Super hilarious. Yeah. Uh-huh. And she's clean too, right? Which is not necessarily common at the womb because there's already so many guidelines that like, if you want to talk about, it's a sex positive room. Mm-hmm. And it's also like, I don't tell people not to swear. Because there's a lot of clubs that do, like, where they're like, because they want a clean.
So, like, you have to work clean, but you can be, like, misogynist.
Exactly. You can. Mm-hmm. Totally. Mm-hmm. It's just different guidelines. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you have, I mean, people coming from all walks of life.
All walks of life.
All kind of careers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had homeless people do my mic as well. Like, there's one woman who, she just goes by one name, and she wandered down, and she was like, I'm cold. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I open comedy open mic. She's like, do you mind if I watch? I'm like, of course, come on in. Like, whatever. And then she watched for a while. She's like, do you mind if next week I come and try it? I was like, yeah, totally.
What was her set like?
Problematic. But, I mean, if you live on the streets, like, you've seen some stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She used the word pussy a lot. And I was like, well, you know, like, it's sort of celebratory. So, yeah, she was really cool. And so she'll pop in, like, once in a while. I have a 94-year-old woman who does my room, like, once a month, Georgie Kunkel. She was Rosie the Riveter. She's incredible. Like, people are always like, oh, she's so sweet. I'm like, you've never driven a car with her before. Like, I drove her from her house to the mic once because she couldn't get a ride. And she is the most incredible human. You know what I mean? Like, it's in our natures to, like, see an old person and sort of, like, do this, which is what you did, like, to your heart. Right. Oh, it's so sweet. But she's kick-ass. You know what I mean? Like, she'll message me at, like, 3 o'clock in the morning, be like, oh, I'm thinking about this stuff. And, like, she was married for a long time, and now she's dating this 91-year-old. I guess he's probably 92 or 90 by now. She's 94 now. She's like, you know, I feel like a little bit, like a bigamist. And she talks about it on stage and stuff, too, because she was married to this wonderful person, and now she's dating another person, and, like, monogamy was this thing. And she was, like, the 11th child she's incredible. She's a phenomenal human. And she, I'm trying to think of a word that isn't ball busting. She doesn't put up with shit. Like, she'll watch some guy from stage. She'll be like, that guy came up and talked a lot about his penis. Oh, well. And she carries a little book that says sex on it. Because when her husband died of cancer, they told her that he was going to not be able to have a lot of sex at the end stages. And so she was like, well, let's talk about sex and let's have more sex before that happens. Like, so, you know what I mean? She just breaks a lot of the stereotypes that we have about older people being sort of prudish and, like, not understanding our world. And she's such an inspiration. She did a 20-minute set once, and then we sent it to America's Got Talent, and she's going to be on this season of America's Got Talent.
Are you serious?
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's her name again?
Georgie Kunkel. You should interview her.
Georgie Kunkel.
Yeah, she loves being interviewed. loves it.
Writing that down. Yeah. Well, I am reminded of my great aunt who passed a couple of years ago, but she was, she was in the Marines as a transportation sergeant,
mm-hmm.
and she didn't like the nursing home she was in, mm-hmm. and so she escaped, and they call it eloping, like they do for, right. You know, if you run off and get married, and
uh-huh.
there was a birthday party, and she pinpointed the exit that would not be covered by staff, and she almost got all the way out to the rural highway, and this is in northern Wisconsin, with her walker, that's, and the so state troopers incredible. Had to, but you know, it worked, you know, she got, her relatives listened and put her in a different,
yeah, facility. As you should. If but someone's escaping, yeah.
There's something liberating about, especially when you hit 90, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, about giving woman. No more shits.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying really hard this year to be the year that I give no more shits. It's really hard, because I still do care about a lot of people and a lot of things. But being 94.
So if 94 years old, I'm guessing, is the oldest comic you've had,
mm-hmm.
how old has the youngest comic been?
21?
Oh, right, because they have to be, kind of, for the space at the rendezvous.
Right, but I do have another, like, I started another open mic at a bookstore in Greenwood, which my friend Meredith took over, my friend Ian, and they're going to start going. It was a comedy womb open mic, and it was, like, the third Friday or fourth Friday of every month, and starting in April for the birthday, it's going to be weekly on Thursdays, and it's an all-ages open mic. So we do have comics where 18 and 19 go there. Mm. I mean, comedy's sort of interesting, right? Like, because I did. Like, my first comic was a 14-year-old boy. And I mean, there's a demographic for that sort of comedy. But, and I mean, sometimes the younger you are, the less fear you have of talking about things. And you're closer, and you have more time, also.
And you're able to let it be raw without having all those lenses that you put on of, should I be talking about this?
Totally, or... exactly. Yeah, so I do, like, I have 21-year-old comics, 22-year-old comics and that do the womb and stuff. And it's, and yeah, but it's so nice because there's a scaffolding of, like, different ages and different genders and, like, different sexualities and different backgrounds and cultures and races. And, like, it's just, and we're all working together and we're colleagues and we can talk to each other and it's super fucking awesome. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Okay, I keep on, like, lowering my voice and then swearing anyway for some strange reason. but yeah, no, it's phenomenal. So, yeah, that it's not a homogenous space is very cool, and that you get to hear stories. Like, one of my favorite comics, Andy Iwancio, she works my door every single week, and she gets on stage, and she always starts with, like, hey, and she sits down on the stool. How are you? How are you? I'm good. I'm Andy, and I'm a trans woman, and let's talk about that up top, and then going to her experience, and, like, that's some, for some people, that's the only trans woman they're gonna see.
Was she the one who did that?
Did she knock over chairs?
She was, like, going around the entire room through
did
the
audience.
Did I
warn you guys first about it?
Because I think you were just like, you guys need to see this.
Oh, right,
you
yeah.
need to see, mm-hmm. I just, yeah. I'm putting her in, you need to see this.
And normally I don't let the people interact with the audience, but I trust her, yeah.
It was phenomenal.
She's incredible. She's so good.
Yeah. It was just kind of beyond for me. Uh-huh. It was just...
Right. Exactly. And, like, and that's why I wanted to, like, warn you guys about. Because I was, like, I'm like, she's like, can I do that again? Because she'd done it the week before, and it had been so sort of life-changing and game-changing. And her comedy, like, it's silly, it's funny, it's topical, but it's also her life, and she gets to talk about her life. And it's not a life you hear about all the time. You know what I mean? And she works the door, like, religiously. She's there every 7 p.m. door. And so her and I, we work so well together. And it's just, and I give her 2 slots a night. Her and I are the only people who get 2 slots a night because we're both there all night.
Right.
Yeah, and so, yeah, she's, oh, I love her so much.
So you had just, and at that show, you had just been on tour, touring?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about that tour a little bit?
Sure. Last summer, my friend Val, she started The Womb, I guess, or she had been doing comedy elsewhere, and then someone had told her about The Womb, and she's really good, and she said, hey, I have this idea about doing a tour, and I was like, well, I want to do a tour someday, but I don't have the bandwidth to do it by myself, so if you want to plan it and organize it, like, I'll help. So she's like, okay. So my friend Finn, he's a trans dude and, like, super supportive of The Womb, and Val, Finn, and I got together, like, every Tuesday, and would talk about how to run this tour. And we put out submissions, so we got probably about 20 people who applied. We took 13 comics across Olympia, Portland, the Bay Area, LA, and back. And we took 2 documentary filmmakers with us, one who's a comic and one who doesn't do comedy. And it was really incredible to sort of watch it being documented, because not every space is going to be safer like the comedy room is. And so there was a little bit of pushback. One room in San Francisco where this guy went on stage and he was being a racist, misogynist asshole. He was being mean to this really gentle, like, former Muslim gay man in the audience who was really, like, he was heckling a little bit, but he was more, like, just being super excited to be there. And he was being mean to him. He was just being mean in general. And then I guess we must have started talking at the back, because no one was laughing at his jokes. He'd burned the light by, like, 5 minutes or something. Yeah, which is not okay.
Right.
Going over, because we also had to get stage time, too. And the audience was not happy with him. And at one point, he'd said something about if all the women were gone, that the world would be quieter. And he said it again, if all the women were dead, the world would be quieter. And he was looking at us, and then the sweetest, most adorable, most wonderful ukulele-playing comic that we had on tour, Casey Middaugh, yells, you fucker. And he goes, excuse me? Are you trying to interrupt my jokes, or whatever it is he said? And my friend Natalie Holt goes, are you telling jokes now? The audience uproars.
Exploded in laughter.
Right, because they were just
that was the truth of that moment.
Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. And we don't normally heckle, but we came from the show, which was a heckling show. That's what the purpose of it was, like a helpful heckling show in San Francisco just before that. So we just finished yelling at comics for fun. And so I think we already had that. And then he was like, if I had the time, which he already gone over by 5 minutes, if I had the time, I'd deal with that crazy frizzy-haired bitch. And then he left out the back.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's sort of the, like you forget that that happens when you, because I'm in the womb all of the time. And then I got to host an open mic in LA, and we did a show there. It was like in the Lexington. It's near Skid Row. And all of my comics left because they were so exhausted because we'd been driving and like performing for like days. But I didn't want to leave because I was hosting this open mic and I was super excited, and I got on stage and I was like, hey. And there was not one audience member. It was just comics. There was like 40 seats empty in comics. And there was like, they all came out to see my hosting set. And I was like, hey, I run a hate-free space. So I haven't seen a lot of hate in the last few years. I don't know what I'm going to do if I see it. Like, I might light you early, but I don't know. So you have 4 minutes, maybe.
And that's how you set it up?
Mm-hmm, pretty much. And then I did a set about how I think everyone should be sending dick pics and boob shots and, like, so that no one had control of our bodies anymore. If everyone's just doing it, no one can say anything about it. You're like, oh, yeah, no, I sent... What?
Everyone does that.
Right, exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, people controlling our bodies and leaking stuff is just, like... Yeah, we all have... We're just, like, one thin layer away from naked all of the time. You know that, right? Like, stop it. You can't control my body anymore. Anyway, so it was sort of, like, this funny thing. And, like, one of the first comics to go up used the F word. Like, not the fun F word, but, like, the homophobic F word multiple times in his set. And he wasn't a homosexual man at all. And so I lit him early. And he's like... And he says on stage, I thought I had 4 minutes. I said, if you're funny... And then, so I sort of set the tone where I was just, like, hard ass. And that's how I worked it. And every time I saw a set that I loved, I would say, I'm going to buy you a bus ticket to Seattle. And one guy gets up, and he was really good, and he talked about homeless issues and stuff. And you could tell that he'd been homeless at some point in his life, or maybe he was currently homeless. And it was so thoughtful. And I just said, you know, I'm going to buy you a bus ticket to Seattle. And he actually took me up on it. Later, and he didn't ask for a bus ticket, but he came out, and I put him up at a hostel, and he did some of the shows, and it was so nice, like, and, like, we're so welcoming in Seattle that he was just like, oh, this is so nice, just to, like, because in L.A., it's got to be tooth and nail, right, because everyone's going there to succeed. Here, we're just here to start, and, like, we're not, there's no infrastructure for succeeding in Seattle. You have to go someplace else right now. We don't have a festival. We have a comedy competition that happens, an international comedy competition that happens, like, once a year, but we don't have a lot of steps up. There's comedy clubs and stuff, but I think you have to leave to get better and then come back. I'm not sure. I'm still trying to figure out how to make it...
That makes sense.
...easier for people. But so, because we don't have that sort of competitive, super competitive nature, we're more welcoming, I think. That's how I feel.
Mm. So, what... advice would you have for people who are either aspiring comics or they're listening to this and they're like, I could go up there and maybe try 3 minutes?
Yeah, you totally can. Write 2. Expect a minute of laughter. Just 2 minutes. And then, like, talk about your life and the things that you find funny, right? Like, because I like the different things. Like, don't try to mimic someone else. Just be you. Like, I think that's the... advice that I would give, because that's the exciting part, is like finding people who are like have a completely different perspective and throws you right off.
Do you find that people come in and they sort of, I saw people had a lot of notes, or about half of the people came up with notebooks.
Yeah.
So do you think that's helpful to go up there and sort of be like, these are 6 things that I might want to talk about?
Yeah, for sure. Totally. It's an open mic. You don't have to be perfect. I mean, some people memorize their sets. It just depends on like, there's no right way to start. You just have to do it.
That's empowering.
Yeah.
That's empowering right there.
Uh-huh.
So if they wanted to perform at the Comedy Womb, what would they do?
Sign-ups are on Sunday at noon. I would recommend messaging me as close to noon as possible at Comedy Womb Forever comedyroomforever@gmail.com. I did have the comedy room one, but I lost the password for it, so now it's comedy room forever. Just sort of. And or finding me on Facebook, Danielle K.L. Gregoire, and sending me a message and being like, I friended you because I'm interested in doing this, because I get a lot of friend requests and I have to be careful about who I friend, because when you're a feminist, you don't always get the nicest right. people wanting to be your friends. So, yeah, it's super easy. And even if you message me at any time, if it's your first time, just message me and, like, be like, I need to get up. I want to get up. Or I would recommend coming to the mic first, watching it, getting the idea of the vibe. Yeah, exactly. And then you'll be more comfortable. And then I'll invite you at 6:30 on a Tuesday night, and I'll walk you through how to get on stage and how to take the microphone out of the stand and put it behind you. And, like, I'll make it easier for you. That's the whole point of the room, is that I want you to be there. And I want to help.
And if people wanted to be audience members...
Yeah, you could just come and pay $5. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, there's tons. Like, there's a lot of people who just love comedy and watching it and don't want to perform. They're the best. I love the comics, but I also love the people who are just like, I just really want to go out and, like, enjoy myself for the night. So if you're like, I don't like heckling people, great. I don't like to talk at my table when live performers are on stage. Great. Like, those are the things. That so 7 and 9 o'clock every Tuesday. We also have hate-free shows 3 nights a week. So Mondays there's the Magic Hat, run by Emmett Montgomery, which is the most beautiful show. I originally asked him to do it because I didn't want to have to be there every night of the week, and I trust him, and he's incredible, and he runs, like, Weird and Awesome the first Sunday of every month at the Annex, which is, like, mm-hmm. a beautiful selection of weird stuff and beautiful, like, hilarious, touching things for all of Seattle. Like, the underbelly of Seattle. Oh, so good. Anyway, so he does the Magic Hat on Mondays, and I've only missed 2 of them out of 35 of them.
How?
Right. Because it's such a good show. Like, I go there, I look forward to Mondays because it's so renewing, and you can put your name in the hat and do, like, a 5-minute story or show and tell or a character or talk about your day, like, puppet show, music. Like, it's really sort of, like, your, as long as it's a little bit funny, and it has a bit of whimsy in it, or honesty, or truth, and it's not hateful, it's totally welcome. And then there's 5 professional comics that come and do stuff. So it's a really cool show. And then Wednesdays, there's other shows too. Like, there's the first Wednesday of the month is changing to, like, your grandfather's TV. It's like a sketch show.
How interesting.
And then the second one of the month, it's in April, is going to be this incredible superhero interview show. So people, anyone can come down and pretend to be their own superhero and be interviewed on stage. So it's like a group play.
Where is this?
At the same place, at the Grotto. It's, yeah, this is all happening in the Grotto. It's the comedy room 3 nights a week. So, and then, yeah, so, like, just, there's so much fun. You can just pay $5 at 7 o'clock on any night and come down, and 9 o'clock on Tuesdays. So.
And I think what's important for people to know is to be invited mm-hmm. to something like this, even if you don't know anyone or if you don't know anything yeah. about comedy, and how it's, I think, it's a radical act to support something like this. Mm-hmm. To come and say, yes, I want to put my $5 behind a hate-free space.
Right, totally. Yeah, 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 for sure. Yeah, the more people that come, the more I feel like there's a reason I'm doing it. And I mean, I do, like, sometimes sell out both shows every Tuesday night, and the Magic Hat is growing, and we get, like, 35 to 40 people coming out. And last night we had the Gay Uncle Time, which is my friend Jeffrey Robert, and he does, he's 56 years old, and he grew up in San Francisco, and he was gay when AIDS happened, and so he lost a lot of friends, lovers, to that, and he just wants people to remember what the culture he came from was about. And so he does, like, a half-hour monologue with, he paints things all year round, and he talks about different things. And it's just, it's brilliant. And then he has, like, drag queens and comics and people of the community, queer people, gay people, like, just, it's so good. And that one sells out, and it's the 3rd Wednesday of the month. It's, and then the 4th Wednesday of the month is going, in April, is going to change. And my friend Elle, who they started, they came and watched a show one night, and there was this cokehead in the audience, and he yelled, he came out to talk to me, and as just as I was meeting Elle, and Elle was sharing their story about how they had blood cancer and were not feeling well and were excited about maybe trying stand-up after, like, years and years of not doing it, and they're trans, and they were standing there and we're having this beautiful discussion about how the show meant something to them. And they're like, oh my God, I feel safe here. And like, I want to do this. And this guy, this horrible guy walks up and he's like, are you friends? And Al and I are like, well, we just met. And he was like, well, and he just started saying these horrible things to us. And eventually Al was just like, I have to walk away, because Al was presenting as male at the point. Right. And, they're trans women. And so, but this guy was just right on, like, wanting to fight someone. And so Elle walks away. And Elle is just, like, sort of gave me this, like, I trust you. You're going to be able to handle this. And I was like, yeah. So, anyway. But this guy, I eventually took him back into the audience. He was kicking my shoes and, like, making fun of me. And I was not reacting at all. And I was like, why don't you just sit? There's only 10 minutes left. Sit with your friends. And at just 4 minutes before the end of my feature set, he yells, bitch, from the audience. And I walk into the room and I know right away it's him. And I just look at him. And I put, like, my hand to stand up. I'm like, stand up. Leave right now. And I was like, don't you say another fucking word. You go up those stairs and you don't come back downstairs. And the whole audience is like, and I was like, was anyone his friend? And the audience was like, no. I'm like, okay, so we're okay that I kicked him out. And the audience just sort of erupted in cheers and stuff. Yeah. Right? Because they're like, this 5'1" woman who runs a room was able to handle it. And they had my back. You know what I mean? And Elle was there too. And so they started comedy the next week. And the whole point of the story is that now they're going to be doing a show the 4th Wednesday of the month, like a sort of like a variety show. And the people who are starting it are like trans and people of color and like women. And like, it's just, it's all different people and it's going to be incredible. And I'm super excited that there's this space where like, I can just be like, hey, make something up. Invite some people out. Let's see what happens. Where is the comedy going to go from here? So, that's the womb.
That's amazing. That, and what an incredible accomplishment. That's just, it keeps growing out into different directions. Mm-hmm. So, if people want to get information, the best place is comedywomb.com.
Yeah, or just comedywombforever@gmail. Just send me a message, and I write every single person back. And if you're interested in doing a workshop, just message me. If you're like, oh, a whole bunch of us want to do a workshop, I can put together a workshop, like a stand-up workshop, and get some comics in to teach it and stuff. So.
And you have some exciting people coming.
Oh my God!
In April, and it's tell crazy. Us a little about that.
So I started doing this national headliner set. The Wins Funding Alliance bankrolled the first one in January. Brought nice. Cameron Esposito and her fiance Rhea Butcher.
Cameron Esposito.
Yeah, she
so
sold
much.
Out 2 shows.
Wow. This is theater off Jackson, right?
This was at Rebar, the first one.
Okay, sure.
And then I had the second one at theater off Jackson. And Melissa Villasenor, who was on, like, Adventure Time and, like, America's Got Talent when she was a kid, and she does impressions, she did the second show. And the third show will have passed by the time this podcast comes out, but it's this Sunday, and it's Heather Thompson. And it's just about getting more women on stage, because often they have to wait so long because there's such a gigantic run of men who have paid their dues.
Right.
Right, and so you would have to wait 15,000 years to finally headline, because we're behind. And so I'm
circumventing the system.
Right. Because it's not fair.
And so who can people look forward to in April?
Corinda Dobbins is coming. She opened for W. Kamau Bell. She's calls herself a quadruple threat. She's Black, lesbian, single mother, and techie. And she,
bam.
Yeah, she's hilarious. You should look her up online. She's incredible. She's from the Bay Area, and I'm super excited to have her. And then in May.
And when is that performance?
April 26th at Theater Off Jackson at 7 o'clock. And it comes with, like, an up-top sampling of, like, local comics who are just starting out, which is really excited to get them in front of an audience of, like, 150 people. And then a local host and a local feature, because I was really looking for a way to get people to come watch local comedy at a larger scale. And if you have a national headliner that's coming in, it's kind of exciting. And then in May, Rye Silverman, who's a trans woman from L.A., she's incredible. She just recorded her album and hilarious and been doing comedy since she was 19, wow. I think. So, yeah, super funny, and she's coming out, and I'm super excited. And then in June, Aparna Nancharla is coming back, and she's from New York, and she's this magical human that you have to see. She's so funny. So funny. Yeah, so, and then for every show, there's, like, local acts up front, too, and that's all Theater Off Jackson, and you can find those online, and the stranger's selling tickets for them, so. Mm-hmm. There's that. There's so much going on. It's crazy. and amazing and wonderful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been an interview chock full of goodness, and it kind of gives me hope.
Thank you.
Looking forward to women in comedy, and I guess just if you see something, if you see a landscape socially or whatever, where you're not seeing the things you want to, empower yourself to create it. It's sort of like the message I'm getting
from exactly.
the arc of this interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if the comedy room isn't providing exactly what you want, start your own mic. I totally support that. You know what I mean? Like, if there's something else that I'm not doing because I can't do everything, do it.
Do it. That's the message, everyone. Well, Danielle, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Excellent.